Hi, I'm Deborah Bowman, and I'm going to talk today about what is significance. We're going to have a discussion in two parts. It might take a while, so grab a cup of tea. I want you to imagine you're in a training session. In this training session, you would discuss issues, concepts, ideas, all sorts of things would arise. Well, I'll be discussing these by myself. Now, we're looking at a slide set. Many of these slides are from a conference that was held in 2007, looking at issues on significance. And this one was held in Maastricht. It's called Subject Matters, looking at content, the meanings, values, and significance of objects and collections. Applications in the museum setting and priority setting. These headings and text images were devised by Ian Cook from Australia. He presented from the Asia Pacific. Now, I am not sure what Ian said when he spoke to these text images. However, I don't think that really matters. What you'll be doing is engaging in a global conversation. Really, the question is the key. The exploration of the concept is the key. And you may discuss these matters further with your colleagues in your own museum. Now, looking at the first slide, all objects are not created equal. We're going to discuss a few issues surrounding, well, really the first four slides. Objects acquire value for a variety of reasons. It could be scarcity, or it could be a form of cultural prestige. From a museum perspective, economic value, or notional economic value, does not necessarily make the object valuable. Value is often derived from association with a historical event. For example, Robert O'Hara Burke's revolver. Or if we look at colonial furniture, it might be to do with issues of scarcity and recognizing that this furniture is representative of a particular period. Now, if we move on, the Taj Mahal, the Sydney Opera House, we recognise that some objects have outstanding universal value. Some of these buildings transcend most ideas of value based on their representation of phases of architectural development. They are iconic. They seem to have a value which is embedded in themselves. People go to see them because of what they are. And some have great symbolic meaning. Think of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. These have iconic status. They have value because of what they represent and what they can do to us. We like to look at items in our cultural stock because they give pleasure. It might be aesthetic. They might be a device to stimulate us by association. For example, Shackleton's boat, the James Caird, acts as a device to allow us to gain understanding of the precarious and heroic journey from Elephant Island to South Georgia. Other items can provoke, inform, reassure, challenge, confirm, uplift. For instance, they can provoke a sense of injustice. Look at devices like leg irons used on convicts, chains around Aboriginal necks. You could go to the Kenmore Hospital and Museum, where visitors can step back into a 19th century psychiatric asylum. They can inform us about the way people lived in the 19th or 20th century, such as Calthorpe's house in the ACT or the Swan Hill Pioneer Settlement. They can reassure us. Look at sporting memorabilia, Bradman's bat. Bradman's Adelaide House and the original family home in Bowral have been heritage listed. They can certainly challenge us. Think of slavery museums, piles of shoes in concentration camps, skulls in Cambodia. Where we look at the body, we can look at corsetry, birthing chairs, straitjackets, gags. They can confirm. Think of the dig tree. This proves the event occurred. And they can uplift, such as artifacts from prisoners of war, diaries, letters, Simpson and his donkey. The trick when collecting items for museum collections is to select items which can inspire, provoke, and inform. And this is done by selecting things which are the best or the only examples. Robert O'Hara Burke had a Tranta revolver. They are not unique. Many were manufactured. But he took two with him on the expedition to the Gulf. Now, looking at horses, as you know, any farming district will possibly have hundreds of horse collars, bits, bridles, saddles, and horseshoes. It would make no sense to collect and display them all. Before a piece of equine equipment should be collected, it would be important to know if it was particularly intricately or beautifully made, therefore gives pleasure, has a story which is inspirational, for example, a rescue, or a story from the Man from Snowy River Museum, which has a small jail, a one-room jail, and it has the story attached to that jail of a man called Wild Wright, who was an associate of Ned Kelly. He spent a night in this lockup for cruelty to a horse. It could be provocative, used in a context that challenges our current ideas, for example, a pit pony. It could let us know how things were done, for example, horse teams. And it could reassure us by reminding us of the heritage way of doing things. It could uplift us. Think of Farlap. These considerations sit behind the process we have adopted to guide you through the steps of determining significance. In the end, the calculation of the significance of an object will be determined by the particular historic, aesthetic, scientific and social values that an object has for past, present and future generations. An Australian slouch hat, ammunition belt or puttees would be of limited significance in Dodge City, Kansas. But back in Oz, if these things belonged to a celebrated local soldier such as Albert Jacka VC, then in his local museum they would have high significance. Now, to do significance assessment, we need to know a lot about the item, its provenance, that is, its history, our collection policy, and the social and cultural interests of our district. Another slide looks at piles of stones, or are they objects with meaning? Not all objects are immediately clear as artifacts which have a utilitarian purpose, yet they may have cultural value. Arrangements of rocks, for example, can be found in many parts of the world. Here in Australia, we have ceremonial rock arrangements. In many parts of the country, Aboriginal quarries, even middens, and we have many informal structures which the European settlers have created, such as cairns, rock spits, and other items which have been created by surveyors and landholders. There are other more informal structures which people create which have cultural or votive value. Even in New South Wales, down near Mimosa Beach, there are piles of cairns on a rocky shore. Why are they there? The next slide, material fabric and method of manufacture influence how we think about the authentic. In a world in which most of our items are mass-produced, there is an apparent anonymity of products, although some mass-produced items can acquire significance as a consequence of their association with an individual. In the National Museum of Australia, there is a life jacket worn by Bob Brown during his campaign to save the Franklin River. And there is also the matinee jacket worn by Azaria Chamberlain. Handmade items can have a significance as a result of the marks of the maker and the unique qualities that the maker has invested in the item. The use of tools or the idiosyncratic method of construction can accentuate the uniqueness of an item. A quilt or a piece of embroidery can have unique qualities in design which may directly relate to the place and time of its making. Now we're going to look at context powerfully shapes our ideas and our views. Context adds to the value of an object. Mawson's hut in Antarctica has greater conservation value in its location than it would have if it were removed to another location. The dig tree has much of its value because it is located in the situation in which the dramatic moments of the Burke and Wills expedition took place. Some, but not all, objects gain significance from the context in which they are located. We can see them round the world when we travel to places where iconic objects are located. What is authentic? Does it come from use? In an age of mass production and mass tourism, we can have appropriation of cultural objects and a stripping of value through relocation. Religious statuary can be mass-produced, yet has a powerful significance in the original culture, whereas the same item moved into another cultural context can strip the object of its significance. We have seen this with representations of the Buddha, which are treated with great reverence in their home culture, yet might be used as decoration in a new cultural context. Size and age on our perceptions. Inevitably, there is a tendency to see the monumental as more significant than smaller items. Great cathedrals, sporting venues, and ruins attract people from all over the world. Think of places you would like to visit on a European trip. Your destinations might include the Parthenon, St. Paul's Cathedral, the Acropolis, Stonehenge, Notre Dame, or the Basilica of St. Basil. These are structures which tend to get World Heritage listing. And given the spiritual, cultural, and monumental value of these structures, it makes sense. However, smaller, less dominant structures can have great significance and value. Beatrix Potter's cottage, Dove Cottage in the Lakes District, or a house in which Keats lived, all have deep cultural significance. Monumental structures were built for monumental purposes, and culturally, we're going to be entranced by them. That is part of the reason why they were built as they were. However, smaller structures can have just as profound and enduring associations. It's a matter of knowing the culture, the stories that are embedded in them, and being able to assess them in an objective way. As we know, significance can be embedded in objects as a consequence of association. A brooch, ring, hat pin, hat, or pair of shoes can acquire great significance as a consequence of this association. Over the centuries, the Christian tradition has been centered on relics of saints, a scapula, a ring, chalice, lock of hair, or some other remains. They could be the central point of a pilgrimage. And we find in museums items also from secular figures, clothing from Catherine the Great, Anne Boleyn, Marie Antoinette. Now, this will be the end of part one. Part two will continue by defining significance more and looking at a significance assessment process, which hopefully will ensure consistency and reliability. See you then. Bye.